Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome everyone to Africa on the Move. That's right. We said Africa on the Move. This is a special program that we are doing for the community. And one of the reasons why we are doing this particular program tonight, we believe there's a need, an urgency, to have a serious critical discussion on what is going on in our community. And the theme question tonight on Africa on the Move center around what must be done in the African community to change our current realities. Now, one of the things what we often try to do on this particular program, Africa on the Move, is to deal with subject matter that is very important to our community and subject matters that are often left out of mainstream media or subject matters that even among some segments of the African community, i.e. our so-called political leadership, many times they have a tendency to avoid crucial information that is related to the interests of the masses of our people. So what we want to do at all times is to be truthful, be honest, and speak truth to power. So what makes our show different from other shows is that this is a foundation for us, is to deal with those issues that are permanent, important to our people. And even mean speaking truth to power, so shall it be. So tonight, we want to really have a critical discussion on what must be done in our community. As you look at our community, the African community, however you may define it, you'll find some things we have in common. You'll find that we are organized to be disorganized. You'll find that there's a high degree of self-hatred. You'll find this question of this huge impact as it comes to or deal with this concept of miseducation of our youth. You'll find this whole question of fear among our people. And in essence, all of these tendencies and behaviors and characteristics, this is what we call variations of oppression. And we like to have a discussion in terms of, at this time, what must be done and where else can we best start with in terms of dealing with our best and our brightest. We got some of the best and the brightest minds within our community that can speak to us tonight. And on the subject tonight, we have with us Brother Haki, who is an organizer and a writer. He will briefly introduce himself. Brother Haki, welcome to Africa on the Move. Just tell the people a little bit about who Haki is.
Sure. I've been involved in organization around the African community, particularly around social justice, for the last 30 years. I'm currently a member of Africa Awareness, and I'm deeply committed to the idea in terms of social and economic justice as related to African people.
Good. Next, we have with us Brother Bamboshi Shango, who is the organizer for the All African People Revolutionary Party. Brother Bamboshi, will you tell our people a little bit something about who you are?
Yes, my name is Bamboshi. I came here from the Caribbean. I've been an organizer since 1968, and I'm a member and organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party. I'm also on the board of directors of the Alliance for Global Justice, and I'm a co-chair of the National Network on Cuba.
And I would like to make that distinction in terms of introducing our brother Bamboshi to recognize that, yes, he is a member of the All African People Revolutionary Party, but also we understand, like a lot of time in history, there's a lot of different splits within our movement, and right now he is organized for the AAPRPGC. Going forward, we have with us Katie Fulton, who is a mother, an educator, and a psychiatrist by profession. And she can tell us a little something about her. Sister Katie, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Thank you very much. My name is Katie, and I reside in Colorado. And my son and I are struggling for our lives right now. I have been struggling with this case for the last year based on computers. It appears as though a county in Colorado, Douglas County, a largely white county, has brought charges against my son, which are very unfair and unjust. These charges are based solely on the fact that they have connected themselves to us because they had people who were surfing the Internet and found that they said to me that something was coming into my home according to their investigation, and I had no idea what they were talking about. As it turns out, they came to my home and seized our computers, cell phone, camera, cash, cards, anything that they thought would build a case against my son. He's never had a problem with the law. He completed his education at the University of Colorado. I am a licensed professional counselor in the state, and I'm also working with families for many years, and we have never had a problem until now. It seems as though he's recently been targeted, and the target that they're using is the computer. So he's facing three felonies right now in the state of Colorado, and we're struggling for his life and his safety. And we're hoping to share our experience with anyone who cares to learn more about how volatile that one can be in this digital era.
Okay, on that note, we'd like to say we'll talk a little bit later as it relates to Sister Katie's issue, particularly as it relates to our youth in general. So we'd like to move forward with our brother, Mel Smith. He lives in the northeast area of the United States. He's also an educator and an intellectual and writer. And Brother Mel, will you tell our people just a little bit about you?
Yes, yes, Lee. I'm here in the Springfield, Massachusetts area and have been off and on through the years, but have been living and working across the country as well, as far as Oakland, California, Washington, D.C. I was actually raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Southern Virginia. So I've spent time across this country, and I've worked it variously, even though I'm an educator, organizer, writer. I've done quite a few things in those various locations. I've driven cabs, served as hospital orderly. I've been substitute teacher as well as a university professor. And so I've seen the nature of America as well as a little outside of it. And I'm a person who's continuing to look at it and trying to do something on various fronts about our condition now.
Okay, and we'll move on to our sister, Dr. Ken Allen, who is an anthropologist, and we'd like to welcome Dr. Allen to Africa on the Move. And Dr. Allen, can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Well, my name is Kim, and I've been active as both a researcher and a community activist and advocate since 1997 in the Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina area. On the issue of environmental justice, I've written a bit about that and been active in that down in Carolina. And then most recently, I'm also a trained anthropologist, cultural anthropologist, and since moving back to my hometown of Richmond, Virginia in 2008, I have been active in local community affairs. I was at one point president of the local branch of the Richmond NAACP, and currently I am also, again, a researcher and activist around the issue of, you know, recovering and constructing knowledge around Richmond's historical and cultural resources as it relates to the period of enslavement in an area in town called Chaco Bottom.
And next we have with us Professor Rose Lee, who not only is she's an educator, but I believe she has a specialty in women's studies, but she would tell us a little bit more about who is Rose Lee. Sister Rose, welcome to Africa on the Moon. Can you share with our people bit about who you are?
Thank you very much. I'm an instructor at Milwaukee Area Technical College in sociology. I worked before at VCU in Richmond, Virginia. My master's are both in sociology and women's studies, and very interested in Black women's studies history. So that's my specialty. Very concerned with young people and teaching young people their social history and social structures in the United States. Thank you.
Excellent. And last but not least, we have a youth member with us, Brother Jababi Robinson. he would tell us a little bit about who he is. So, Jababi, welcome to Africa on the Move. Tell the people a little something about you.
Thank you for having me. I'm a researcher and I'm a constant supporter of Africa on the Move, and I look forward to being able to contribute to this discussion.
Okay, thank you. This is our youth. We have a little youth section, and he's one of our spokesperson. We think the youth is best to speak for the youth. So what we want to do right now, we'll start with Brother Haki. Brother Haki, as a doctor, if you have to give your prognosis of we have a disease that is affecting our community, which is called global oppression, how would you diagnose it? What would be your solution to it? What must be done in our community as relates to our current reality, Brother Haki? What is your prognosis on that?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to first be aware, in fact, that is, in fact, a global issue as related to our longevity in the society. I think there's a lot of changes that are going on in terms of the economy, which our people, by and large, are unaware of. People generally in America are unaware in terms of the changes that are taking place behind the scene. There has been the redistribution of wealth from the poorest sectors of society to the most wealthy sectors of society, to the extent that this kind of imbalance has a deleterious impact on the overall function of the economy. In fact, without the necessary money flowing through the system, then there's no way in terms of conceivably balancing the budget or creating a viable economy. So in the face of this, and despite this reality, there are politicians who persist in maintaining policies, Paul Ryan, which are not in the best interest of the country, or certainly not in the best interest of African people or working class people in the society. So we have to understand these structural maladies that exist in the society and understand their particular impact on the African community, particularly as working people, disposable working people. So we've got to be concerned about that. I think in terms of enlightening people, getting them to that reality, I think it's somewhat problematic. I think on some level, you want to educate people in terms of the economic changes that are taking place in society, but at the same token, you don't want to be so brazen with the point where you actually undermine their motivation in terms of, doing things like academic excellence, standing up, for social justice and so forth and so on. So we have this very peculiar situation in terms of just trying to maintain that balance in terms of giving people the education, the information that they need, but the same token, try to keep them motivated in terms of taking on very difficult challenges that lie ahead for our people. So I think that in terms of just achieving, the kind of things that we need, I think it's paramount that we do the question in terms of education is very, very important to our people. And how we articulate that becomes extremely important. Now, I do realize that, unfortunately, the system is very, very good in terms of, programming people to believe things that are necessarily true. And at the same token, I think that how we express that, it becomes an issue. Because I think that because a lot of the concepts that the politicians use are so convoluted and so complex, it confuses, if not baffles, the majority of the people. So therefore, I think it's our obligation in terms of trying to take those concepts, these ideas, and just clarify for our people exactly what they're talking about and what it means to their lives. So that is a challenge for our people.
Okay, we'd like to thank you, Haki. I will go to Dr. Kim Allen. In terms of your discipline in anthropology, what would you say in terms of your discipline when you look at the African community, what do you think must be done? What are some of the things you have noticed and things that need to be addressed? Dr. Kim.
Well, one of the things, and I operate from the position of researcher and activist, not necessarily do I speak as a cultural anthropologist all the time from the discipline's point of view, but in my activism, what is most clear to me is that we need a place at the decision-making table, and that we must, leverage the capital that we have to affect that decision-making, and we need to also have a shift within our culture, if you will, that allows us to operate from a position of empowerment and self-determination rather than one that looks for others to take care of us, to make decisions for us in our best interest, but rather, as I said, that we act in our own best interest as powerful stakeholders, as decision makers, and there's much that we can do to act in that position, act from that position of power.
Okay, and to our sister Rose Lee, in terms of looking at social policies, from a sociological perspective, what could you contribute as relates to trying to describe in the year 2016 the condition of the African community?
Well, you know, I hate to disagree with people, but
no,
I
that's
don't
fine.
See the
that's
social structures. I don't see the social structures changing. I don't see those in power giving up the power to socially control education, policies, the economics of the community. And right now our community is really suffering, and our children are suffering basically because they're uneducated, because the curriculum is keeping real historical and social education away from our children. And we're allowing it. Our children are they basically know what's on TV and music. And if you talk to young people, and I have every day because I teach in a community college, they all want to be basketball players and rappers. And a lot of, in Milwaukee especially, 66% of our households are headed by women. And in Milwaukee, if you look at the state of Milwaukee, 50% of our young men are from the ages of 16 to 50 are unemployed. It's a real dilemma. Of the 50 states, we're number one in the percentage of incarcerated black males and Hispanic males. In a state that is supposed to be as progressive as any state in the country, and yet we have both Paul Ryan and, of course, Scott Walker as the governor setting policies in this state, the structure isn't going to change. And it has to be us understanding that structure and changing what's going on in our community as leaders. But I don't see power shifting in the United States to make it better for people of color at all. And I'm not trying to be pessimistic. I think it's a social responsibility of the community itself.
Would I like to say to our listening audience for the first hour?
I'm sorry.
No problem. Would I like to say to our listening audience what we're going to do during our first hour of this program? We will be getting analysis and information from some of our best and brightest minds that you have heard so far, and others is to come. And after that, we will open up our phone line to the community, where you can call in at 323-679-0841, 232-679-0841, and that should take place about around 11 o'clock. So we want you to sit back, relax, internalize this information, and then we have some serious critical discussions, dialogue. Sister Kim, before I go to my next caller, is there anything you'd like to maybe raise in your context of the position that you just raised, where I think Rose took a different position about this question of power structure and they would not give up? How would you respond to her response, to your response?
Well, I don't want to be on the defensive here, but I just want to make my point clear. I wasn't suggesting that those in power concede power to those of us who don't have power. What I was suggesting, though, is that as a community, we operate from a position of power, that there is power that we have that we should exercise. And one of the ways that we can exercise the power that we do have is to be an educated and informed citizenry. So there are issues that impact our community that we would do well to become more knowledgeable about, not only in terms of how they impact us on a day-to-day basis, but also how they might impact budgetary decisions and how they might impact policy decisions, and also how there's room for us to assume responsibility for how these things impact us. So, for example, if we look at the arena of education, there is much that we can do to educate ourselves about the budgetary process, how decisions are made to how decisions are made with respect to the budget on whether to allocate monies for transportation, instruction, or what have you, to understand that budgeting process and to be able to weigh in an intelligent and informed manner about what it is that we need in order to have things better for our communities and our children. And then also, there are things that we can do as a community to hold ourselves responsible and accountable for our educational outcomes. And so, for example, before our children get to school by age 5, there are things that we can do in the home and in the community to prepare our children for that first day of school that unfortunately many of us don't do, but it's well within our power to do. So I'm suggesting that there are things that we can do and that we have done historically to self-help that in doing so puts us in a position to operate from a position of power, right, as we then interact with those others who also operate from positions of power.
Okay. Brother Bamboshi, based upon what has been stated so far, as a Pan-Africanist, how do you view this concept of community, and what would you like to add to the subject matter when it comes to what must be done at this point in time in our communities to change our current reality?
Well, I think we're faced with many issues. And unfortunately, our issues aren't just limited to the community. We have many issues that are much wider. For example, the question of global warming today is a primary concern for Africa and African people all over the world, because we will be the ones who will face the brunt of this issue. And according to a recent report from the United Nations, the climate question is a question that is up on us today, and that within 20, 25 years, we might be too late to do anything about it. And if that's the case, then everybody is gone, not just us. But we will face it first by sea waters rising, by scarcity in terms of food, water, in terms of many of the islands in the Caribbean and in the South Pacific going under because of seawater rising. And, you know, there's just so many different aspects of that. The whole question of war, and especially the U.S. war machine, as a major contributor to pollutants, and the question of being anti-war. There's the question of tourism, that while we are speaking right now, there's some 300 tour ships that are carrying over 5,000 and 6,000 people, little cities, and the waste from those ships are completely polluting, especially the pristine areas of the Caribbean and Caribbean Sea, and some of the pollution is causing the loss of reefs, which in turn cause the loss of marine life. So there's a whole host of issues that's much broader than us. But for us as a people, we have the issue of, one, being unorganized, and therefore we can't as a people really face these issues and resolve them until we see how we can become organized. Adding to being organized, we lack any serious political consciousness, so therefore we believe whatever we are told on the television, and we regurgitate it as if it's a reality, when in fact a lot of it is just confusion. So we have problems in that sense. And our continent is in big trouble because it's under attack. AFRICOM is carrying out one mission a day minimum in Africa today. But you don't hear about these wars that the United States is waging in Africa and on Africa and on Africans. So there's many, many problems. And for us, we think that although we have these problems, there are solutions. And the primary solution, or one of the primary solutions, is the fact that we need organization. Only an organized people can deal with the problems that we have.
Okay, we'd like to go to Brother Mayo. Brother Mayo, when we look at our communities, and as the brother alluded to earlier, there are many problems that are facing our people. But as an intellectual, when you looking at or analyzing the problem, you must prioritize certain things and realize there are primary issues and secondary issues. For your understanding, looking at our community, what do you see as being the primary issue of our community, and how can we change the reality? What would be your methodology of attacking the problem?
Well, I think things that have been discussed already right here, right now, these programs, on this program, are primary issues. The the acting from a position of power and recognizing that this system is not going to change for us, and we have to get into an education of our people, re-educating ourselves again, which involves reconceiving of ourselves as a people that has a particular mission, a particular history, and we have to be able to grasp that in order to come with power to develop a self-defining a presence here in this so-called plural democracy. Black people have to assert ourselves. And this is an old, this is an old perspective, and we've not grasped it. We've allowed much to go on and toward an assimilationist, integrationist direction, and have lost a great deal of what we might have gathered in terms of a peoplehood. Asa Hilliard, the late Asa Hilliard, had a description of a peoplehood that pretty much summed up much that we have lost and have to regain. I think all of that that's primary. It's issues that Bambosi just laid out. These are the significant matters that many folk in our community are not discussing and not working to deal with because mainstream doesn't deal with it. And in fact, it diverts any discussion from it. So I think that in terms of recognizing issues, some of us are with that constantly, but in terms of implementing anything that gets action on the ground, we are often at a loss as to where to begin or what to change, and we stumble a bit. I think one prescription for action that I recommend is is laid out in a book by Professor Raymond Winbush, who has written a text, and the title of it is The Warrior Method. It involves the training of our children, the raising of our children, particularly the young boys, and it emphasizes the need of an entire community in this training. The idea of a village takes a village to raise a child. However, he has specific approaches involving parents, teachers, community members in general, and a curriculum of study and practice that engages all in re-engaging the community and the individuals as African people, as Black people who have a common need, interest, and objective. And it essentially is it is an Africana studies and a development of a sense of responsibility, you know, as a people, a collective concern, a set of values, the development of values, and a resistance to the kinds of Americanism that we've been subjected to, which is detrimental to our survival, indeed, as a people. And this warrior method is indeed a very accessible, I think, a plan of action for communities in general, and something that that could be a good starting place for spreading some real action and growth that can lead to a greater concern for the issues of the militarism, racism, and the other ills to which we're subjected and constantly battling.
You know,
organized.
Okay, sorry,
Lee. Sorry, Lee. Just
you know, as I travel throughout, as we travel throughout our communities, one of the things I notice among some of the sectors of our people and in many of our communities is the issue of fear. The issue of fear to know, the fear of not want to know the truth. I think I heard someone say, I think it was a young lady out of Atlanta, Cynthia McKinney, looking at a documentary, she made a statement that our people really don't want to know the truth, because to know the truth means you will have to be responsible. Now, what I would like to do with Sister Katie, as has a discipline in psychology, as a psychiatrist, what are some of the gains or some of the things that are going on in our community that allow our people to create a sense of fear? Because with the fear comes a lot of divisions in terms of not willing to cooperate, support, and help one another. So how do you, Sister Katie, from your analysis, in terms of looking at our community from a fear factor, how do you deal with that, and how do we overcome it?
Well, I think that you are very wise to consider the fact that when people come across as being very angry, behind that anger, there is fear. And you want to ask, what is it that you are afraid of? And once they come to understand what it is that they are really afraid of, then they are no longer so very angry. And that's what racism is about. Racism is an institution. And that's what the sister was reflecting upon when she talked about men being incarcerated at a high rate. Black men are being incarcerated at a very high rate. Therefore, you have a lot of single women without men. Once these men go to prison, they cannot get a job. They get caught up in the loop of selling drugs. In Colorado, we're coming up on what's called a 420, which means that you have thousands of individuals coming from across the country into the state of Colorado, especially Denver, because of the marijuana. So they have the power in Colorado to change the law. They wrote the law to suit their purpose. It says, okay, we don't care what the federal government says. We don't care what marijuana might or might not do to the body and the brain. We want the money. So in January alone, millions of dollars came into Colorado, the marijuana. Professional people, lawyers, doctors, judges, teachers on marijuana, because that's what they want. Therefore, people of color, we
need to be aware as to where the power really is, and that is in the policy. When we are asleep at night, when we're talking to each other like we are now, we're with our families, they're thinking about how to write the law to suit their purpose. And it's done. They don't know what to do with it because Colorado has made it legal. So that's powerful. We as a people, we really do need to communicate with each other to have that impact upon our future. We are just intellectual slaves. There's still chains around our ankles, and we are going to continue to do what they want us to do, and they're going to jerk us any which way they want us to go, because we do not have the intellect, and we do not use that intellect to our advantage. So, yes, we become very comfortable in our homes with our big cars, our big jobs, and everybody likes us. So we say, well, I'm not going to risk my job. I'm not going to risk my home. I'm not going to get involved. They have a problem over there. That's their problem.
Amen.
Sister Rose and Brother Aki, I'd like both of y'all to respond to the comment. She just made a comment about we are intellectual slaves. Now, how do y'all internalize that, and how does that play out in that community, positive or negatively, if it does exist? Sister Rose, you first, particularly from a woman perspective, how do you internalize the concept, intellectual slaves?
I agree with her 200%. We have a very complacent middle-class African-American who are intellectual and we can speak well. That's what we do. We have tried to assimilate, and we do quite well at doing it. We love it. The masses of us are not there, and we don't take responsibility for the masses. They have, and some of us believe it's their fault that they are being so oppressed, because we don't feel like we are oppressed, because we are upper middle class, and we've made it. I agree with her wholeheartedly. And in fact, I hear people who are intellectual slaves say, lock them up. Let's just lock them up and let me get as far away from them as I can. They're an embarrassment. That's why our community, we're talking about empowering. I don't quite get it. When you talk about empowering and our collective power, we don't want collective power. We want to assimilate and acculturate. We want to be a part of America. That's who we are, Americans, and that's what we want to be a part of. So when we see all these young men going to prison, all of these homes, we get embarrassed by the sagging pants. We get embarrassed by the weeds. We get embarrassed by all of these other things. We're still embarrassed by dark skin. I mean, we're still there. I'm sorry. We talk the game. We use big words. Our children do not listen to us because they can't understand us anymore, and we don't relate to them. That's what I see.
So he's definitely speaking the truth to power. Brother Haki, what's your take on this intellectual slave and the doubt of what someone indirectly of this class question, which I have heard you before speak on? Can you articulate a little bit on your position on this intellectual slave and this question of class within our community and how it plays out?
Well, brother, you know, I'm glad you raised the issue of, you know, a class, because you can have a realistic discussion around the concept in terms of intellectual slaves without looking at the question of class. And as the sister alluded to, there's no question there are Africans in the community who think by virtue of that status or the social status or the kind of money they have access to, or they have a house or the car, that in fact that defines them as a human being. And so therefore, in their mind, you know, that they've made it, and so therefore there is no problem. So if there's a problem that exists in African community that structurally, objectively exists, it's not that the problem is one of objectivity, but more of a question of subjectivity, in which the problem resides with the African masses. In fact, if they pull themselves by the bootstraps, they can be just like them. So we understand that class character in terms of the mindset of a lot of our people. But I think implicit in terms of that mindset, I think we have to understand is that there's a kind of self-loathing that exists. I don't care how much education they have, how well they articulate, or what school they went to, or what kind of degrees they have, or how big the house is. There's a certain kind of self-loathing that exists that makes it palatable to accept certain ideas in terms of, you know, how you see yourself as an African person. If your perception is that your being is based upon your possessions, then it doesn't bode well in terms of, you know, your understanding of your own humanity. It doesn't bode well in terms of your understanding of humanity for your people. And so I think therefore, in terms of the whole self-esteem piece, is one of the things that we have to struggle hard over in terms of, you know, having some type of discourse in the community dealing with specifically that question. Of course, it's very, very difficult to engage in that kind of question because nobody wants to say, you know, I feel inferior. They're not going to say that. So this is the problem. But I think, nonetheless, it is something that I think those among us who are conscious of, but they keep raising that question in terms of, you know, just how do we see ourselves as human beings? Why is it that material things define you as a human being? If, in fact, you define yourself based on material possessions, then, therefore, you can reason that those who have more material possessions are more human or better off or better person than you are. And if that's the case, then we need to look at that and ask ourselves, why does that exist? So I think the question in terms of clarity is a quintessential question. It's one that we have to deal with, and it's killing us. It's killing us. But let me just conclude by saying this. The thing we have to understand, as this economy unravels, you may have your big house, your big car, and all, and you're doing well now, and that's fine. But as the economy unravels, as automation takes place, as the global economy continues to expand, there's fewer and fewer jobs, fewer and fewer opportunities for people right here in America. Now, just in terms of the historical role of racism, we've got to be very, very clear in terms of who disproportionately get impacted when jobs go abroad, you know, when automation sets in. Who disproportionately impacted? It's African people. We're clear on that. And so those Africans who are living well, high on the hog today, in 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, may not be living high on the hog then. I would venture to guess that it's probably at that point in which, you know, they lose those things that they're more willing to deal with the question in terms of, you know, our objective condition here in America in terms of the material and the sociological deprivation that exists among our people.
That's right, Brother Akeem.
Okay, Brother Hank, Brother Bambushi, would you like to add to this last point?
I would agree with Akeem. The problem, I think, is that there is a difference between class aspiration. You can aspire to be a middle class. That does not make you a middle class. So there's a difference between class aspiration and class reality. And even as a middle class, you're really not in the position to really have too much because the middle class in the U.S. is dwindling. And the 1% has leaped years ahead of us in terms of the accumulation of cash. If you have to work for money, then you're not part of the 1%. You're just barely in the middle class. You're really part of the working class. And the working class is the class that's most exploited and oppressed inside the United States. But I'm glad that the sister raised the question of power, because here you can see clearly power is a question of class. The upper class, the bourgeois, the 1%, owns and controls everything. You work for them. Some of us, they give more crumbs than the others. But we still don't have what the 1% have. I think that those of us who they can't or won't hire, and obviously under capitalism you can't have mass employment, so instead of mass employment, you have mass incarceration. And not only just mass incarceration, but they give you the problems of drugs, because drugs is a method of control of population. It's population control. So I think that these points that Haki and the sister just hit on, I think Mel touched on them also, are essential points to our discussion. And it's true. Unless we talk about organizing, unless we talk about dealing with these problems from an organized level, we'll never be able to solve them, because tonight the masses of our youth, especially the male youth, exist in two armies. Both armies are our enemy armies and does nothing for us. One is the U.S. military and the other one is a drug army. And we must be clear on that.
Well, that's interesting. Speaking of the youth, we have a youth with us today who's been waiting real patiently. His name is Brother Jabari. Jabari, based upon what you heard so far, as a youth, give us your take. What must be done in our community in order to change our current realities? Brother Jabari, as a youth, speak to us. What is your prognosis of what needs to be done?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me. But my analysis comes from the perspective of looking at how to utilize technology at our disposal, because we know that media influence plays a lot in the perceptions of how black people are viewed in our society, and it's amazing. You can look at certain stereotypes from the 1920s and movies or whatever the popular media of that era was compared to today, and we're still having these issues of a woman being displayed as promiscuous, a young people being displayed as delinquents or criminals of some sort, you know, weak and feminized men. And even you look at the closely related fashion industry, you see the trends basically all of a sudden, you know, it's not acceptable for a man to be a man anymore, but he has to be effeminized, and almost like something they do to break us in, because they always try to give us these roles where we have to put on dresses or put on some type of feminine attire or garment as if that's acceptable, and that's far from reality.
You know, that's interesting. The femination of males in the African community, we definitely see that going on. And with that particular point, I'd like to kind of address this point to Brother Mel. When we talk about this issue of issue of what's going on in our community. And we, you know, one thing we often talk about the educational system, but we also never really look at real critically this question of the role of our political leadership, the political leadership within the African communities. When I say political leadership in African communities, I'm talking about communities throughout from a global perspective. How would you assess, what would be your analysis of how our political communities in terms of leadership has been functioning for the last 30 to 40 years as relates to serving our people? Because that was a notion in which many of us believed that if we got more political power, which means we had more congressmen and senators and people in local elections, that our relationship, our economic conditions will improve. But we can see that we have more people today in these positions, but that the conditions of our people are worse off. So how do you critique that? Can you speak that, talk that about that reality?
It looks as though we have been attempting to just get a bigger piece of a rotten pie. And this is what our political leadership has been involved with. Apparently it's more of the assimilation pattern, trying to be more American and do the same thing that our oppressors were doing, and just do more of it. Well, it hasn't led to anything. Harry Belafonte has been known to have revealed a comment that Martin Luther King Jr. made years ago in what seemed like a very blue moment of some reflection. He says that King told him, admitted to him that he was afraid he was leading his people into a burning house. And I think he had some idea after a long struggle that this this the formidable empire was something other than what many of the civil rights leadership at that time had thought was worthy of fighting to get into, rather than attempting to establish something of an independent nature, contend with it. This is what has been brought on us by the political leadership, or as some of our journalists and pundits have called it, misleadership class. The misleadership, I think, is an accurate description. And we've been subjected to that, and it's just more of the same. The ultimate of that is that we have a president who has been elected with a black face, which in the minds of many people represents the culmination of the struggle of black folks in America, which is absurd. And unfortunately, even many people, surprisingly, who were conscious and freedom fighters, in fact, fell for this kind of brand representation of the current president, which has done as much as anyone else to cool out many of the forces of struggle and many of those who saw that change was needed in this nation, serious structural change, change of power, change of values. Many of those people cooled out because the election of a black president supposedly represented some of that change. Well, it did not. This president is particularly an assimilationist of great proportion, and had no intention of change except to use it as a carrot, and a carrot in his great rhetoric. And he's a great orator and rhetorician who can tell us one thing one day and do the opposite on the very next, and has been doing that. So this is politician. Politicians have been doing this kind of thing for a long, long time, and sometimes are described as being that kind of being a politician. But I think we've seen the pretty much the ultimate of what it can do, because we've allowed ourselves to buy into this this we idea that is not we at all. We have to get back to seeing ourselves as having particular interests, which must be in contention with the status quo and in contention with this this thing which it attempts to absorb everyone into the interest of a very particular ruling class and a racial group. So that's politics. We need a politics of our own, and it's been stated before and long ago. The black power was an attempt to express the ideas of Pan-Africanism, which our politicians have little care for, because it does not serve their interests in supporting AFRICOM and the foreign policy that we're tied to. We being the United States, citizens of the United States, quote unquote. This is not what black people, African people, need to have represent us. So that's my take on the political reality.
Sister Rose, what would be your analysis and your critique of our political leadership in the last 20 to 30 years up to today and its impact on our community?
Well, I have to disagree just a little bit about President Obama and Michelle Obama and their family. I think he has modeled And there, it has been a change of how young men see family. I do think that he has had a lot of opposition to the power structure and therefore has not been able to be effective as a president, because he has come up against the Congress and the way that they want to continue to rule.
Okay. Bambosha, you agree with that? Bambosha, what is your take on political leadership? And particularly the last statement that Sister Rose raised in terms of her analysis of the impact or maybe of the president today, Barack.
Hello?
Yeah, yes, Bush.
Yeah, while the family, the president may be a good role model for the family, I don't think that it's a good role model for our people. And the reason I'm saying it's not a good role model for people is because the presidency is a job. And as a job, you're working for the people who hire you and the people who pay you. And we live under an illusion of democracy. But obviously, if we had democracy, then we would make the decisions, and the people who we elect would implement the decisions that we make. However, they're implementing the decisions that someone else make. And in fact, they are working for those folks who make the decision, and as such, they're neocolonial agents. And as you know, that at one point, most of the countries in Africa were colonies, and they were colonies of Europe because in 1885, the Europeans met in Berlin and decided to divide the continent up amongst themselves. And France took apart, Britain took apart, Portugal took apart, Germany took apart, etc. So as such, you had Africa colonized. You had most of South and Central America colonized, although they got independence much earlier. And you have the Caribbean colonized by these same forces. And while they were colonized, all of the resources in those countries and the people who determined the power for those countries were in Europe. Now we have a slight change of equation, and most of those people are now in the United States. Most of those colonies are quote-unquote independent. But in all reality, we have what's called neocolonialism. And neocolonialism is a new form of colonialism in which, instead of direct colonialism, where European powers control the country directly, you have European powers putting in people who look like me, look like the people in those countries, look like you, to control the countries for Europe and America. And so I'm saying that one of the biggest threats we have today is this threat of neocolonialism. And not only do we have neocolonial agents who run these countries, neocolonial presidents, etc., but we also have a new phenomenon where you have neocolonial intellectuals who rationalize this neocolonialism, who rationalize why it's good that these new people who are neocolonialists should exist and should do this job for Europe and America. So in that sense, I'm asking people to look at the question again. It's nothing personal against Obama. It's nothing personal against any of the other neocolonial agents. But we must be realistic, at least with ourselves. We should not fool ourselves. If we fool ourselves, we can't move forward. That's my take on that.
Can I say something?
Of course you should. And for anybody else, I got the lines open to everyone. You can just join around in. Go ahead, Sister Rose.
Yes, we're acting like we are not Americans in a capitalistic economy. The purpose of a capitalistic economy is for a few to control the masses. That's who we are. We're Americans. We're in America. And, of course, the power structure and the whole social structure, because we're in a capitalistic system, is going to be owners and workers. And if you ask most workers, if you could give them $75,000, they would be happy. They wouldn't care that the one percenters had all the wealth. This is capitalism. It's working well.
Exactly. I agree that this is capitalism. That's what I'm against, because capitalism is a system of exploitation in which
Correct.
The people who work gets minimum benefit, if any at all. Those who do not work control the labor of those who work and benefit most from them. And today, the capitalism has diminished themselves that now has less than 75 families who control almost 80% of the wealth of the world. And, you know, we can say it exists and it's a reality and it can't be changed, or we can try to change it.
Oh, I agree with you.
In terms of this question that you raised, Sister Rose, I'd like to raise it with the young fellow we have with us tonight, Brother Zabari, and Brother Haki. I'd like y'all to take a lead on this particular question. And Sister Katie, part of the issue is the issue of history, how we perceive ourselves. Sister Rose says something I think is something that has been with us since our first arrival over here, in terms of who we really are, who are we. And if we internalize of being something that we are not, that can create a lot of problems. And maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe we are not Americans. And what does it really mean to be Americans, and how does that play out? So in terms of this identity question, Jabari, Haki, and Katie, how do you deal with this issue when you begin to teach our people? If we can control our own educational system, how would you look at this issue of identity, and how would it play a role in terms of future development within your communities? Brother Zimbabwe, can you speak a little bit from a youth perspective? Do you agree with the position we are Americans because of the fact we're here, or do we need to change that ideological way of how we view ourselves and create something or develop something, or at least have another criteria of how we define ourselves and see ourselves? What's your take on that?
Well, we definitely need a reshaping of this ideological question of identity, because as anyone can tell you, the very basis of developing identity starts with a young child, where more than likely they're leaning towards parents, relatives, or older siblings as they develop in terms of what the identity is. And then when they get towards high school or collegiate age, they really start to form their own strong opinions. But nonetheless, it's a matter of doing what's necessary to have our children be instilled that they're black and they should be proud of it, because so often people are trying to coax us into embracing certain behaviors that are not typically custom to what we traditionally as black people have come to embrace. And because of that, you have a lot of confusion, and you notice that we do things differently than what we should be doing.
I wholeheartedly agree. I agree with him very much. I think that when you raise the question about, I'm sorry, this is Katie in Colorado. When you raise the question about identity, I've always said to my classes and to my young people that your identity is a gift to you from significant others. From the time you are born, you are given a gift. If they say to you that you're beautiful, you're smart, you're important, you're loved, you become and you develop an identity for yourself. And if you are conflicted in your identity, then you are going to come across to the other individuals as a person who's really confused. You don't want to be black. You don't want to be poor. You don't want to be on this side. And you begin to embrace something that is very different from how you look. And this is what you're seeing now in a lot of our leaders. A lot of our leaders are conflicted about who they are, how they look, and their self-concept and their identity. And when you are conflicted about who you are, you cannot lead the masses in the way that you're comfortable. And you can see that now. There's a divide. There's a disconnect. I'm not sure if I'm black or white. I'm not sure if I'm rich or poor. I'm not sure if you'll let someone else define you. And if you allow someone else to define who you are, then your policy is going to be conflicted. But when you step out into the world and you realize that you are an important person, that you like yourself, when you look in the mirror, you're okay with what you see, you could be comfortable anywhere you go. It doesn't matter how much money you have in your pocket. It doesn't matter how many degrees you have. You know who you are as a person. And when you bring that power to your existence and to your entire personhood, they might not like you, but they will respect you because you're confident in your leadership. And you know where you're going. And if you don't know where you're going, then you're just an accident waiting to happen. And someone can jerk you this way and jerk you that way. I remember years ago there was an organization that was very committed to the advancement of colored people. But then they started to be infiltrated with people who didn't mean them well. They said, okay, I'm white, I can join. And they started to undermine the goals and objectives of the organization. They said, well, you know what? We've lost our way. We cannot advance colored people because we have to advance all people. But you see, the Tea Party doesn't have a problem with that. They say, no, we don't like this person. We don't want you in our group. We know what we want, and we're going to take it. And if we don't take it, we're going to change the laws to make it look as if we can have it. People of color in America have lost that courage. They have lost that focus. You don't have to be angry and violent, but you need to be committed to something. Your commitment is based on who you are as an individual. And if you don't know who you are, then someone else is going to define you.
Well, Becky?
And that's...
Yeah, well, you know, I take a sort of different position than Sister Rose. My position is that I see myself as a colonized African here in North America. I don't see myself as an American. I really don't. And because I don't see myself as America, there is no desire on my part in terms of to capitulate or to go along, to get along, simply to be part of this. You know what I mean? I have my own values, just my own morality in terms of how I see the world. And because there's such a relationship between morality and power, my responsibility is to challenge. You know, my responsibility is to challenge power. It's not to capitulate to power in terms of in order to fit in. It's to fight power in order to be free. So that is my focus. So when you look at the Africans as a colony, one of the things that's very, very interesting, when you look at the unemployment among the African community in this country, it clearly it functions as a colony. They use us when they need us. When it's to their advantage to profit off us, they use us. When you look at the terms of the prison industrial complex, you look at the larger complex on African people, and you look at terms of the destruction of lives. Isn't that precisely what happens to colonies, not only historically but also contemporary times? When you look at the continent of Africa, you look at the kind of colonization, the impact colonization has on Africa, then you look at the African community, there's a parallel. So therefore, I see myself as an American person. I see myself as an African who colonized in North America, and that's the way I see things. You know, that's my perception.
To Brother Mill, when people talk about this issue of defining who they are and this question of empowerment, a lot of times we got to look at the role of the media, how the media has created scenarios of how people internalize themselves. How are we going to fight this media when the context of the, inside this country around the world?
Are you there?
Yes, I'm there. How do we deal with this question of the media?
Okay, hello. Are you still there?
I'm still there. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Before the media thing, I want to admit this matter of identity reminded me of Malcolm X responding to a comment many years ago at one of his speeches when he was attempting to get across the point of we being an African people, and objections to that idea were stated, from the audience, and Malcolm, just because a cat has kittens in an oven doesn't make them biscuits, and kind of brought the point home. Now I've repeated that to the young people, and gotten various reactions in recent years, and most recently. They had no idea what that meant, because they had no idea that they couldn't picture a kitten being born in an oven. They didn't even know what an oven was or why a cat would be in an oven. But anyway, older folk got that image, and the point was made, I think, about we being an African people, and it goes beyond just that individual.
How you deal with the monopoly? This question of monopoly, you have less than about 3 to 5 companies control all of the various media forms in this country throughout the world. How do, as oppressed people, what is the strategy to deal with that?
Yeah, that's one of the most difficult realities that we're faced with. It just involves alternate and independent media, alternatives and creative uses of those things, even those things as they exist, like internet and social media and the like. And that is being done, as I understand, around the world in various places. It just has to be acknowledged, in the sense that we realize that there is a serious monopoly. And what that monopoly means is, the interests of the powerful are being promoted more exclusively than ever. And many people are not aware of it or don't care to resist it consciously, and therefore are absorbed into it. So there has to be alternative and aggressive alternative media, and again, back to the education and re-education of our people in our community, in our families, in our communities, and the awareness, making it a point to see that people are aware that we are being constantly propagandized by mainstream, and that we need to be aware of it, and therefore do something about it, which is seek alternative sources of information and multiply that process throughout. It's a source and a motivation for organizing that I think is real enough and has benefits in that even the process of doing it will generate some positive results in terms of resisting this monster.
Okay, we'd like to alert our listening audience that you are listening to Africa on the Move. Our phone lines are open now. We'd like for you to call in at 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841. If you have a question or comment, make sure you hit the number one. This is African on the Move. We're in the process of organizing the possibilities where we'll be coming on a weekly basis. That will depend upon the nature of support that we get from our community. But we believe it's very important that we have a vehicle that will speak down in power with your truth, but speak from a perspective and reality of what's in the best interest of our people from a mass perspective. And tonight is an attempt to just to exemplify that particular objective. So again, we'll be on next week from 10 to 12, same time, same station. We'd like you to encourage your friends, if they really want to have a serious dialogue, that Africa on the Move is the place to be. We will have some of the best and some of the brightest, like you're hearing tonight, that comes from our community. So in the process of saying that again, feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. We have about 45 minutes left in the program. And what we'll do right now is we'll go to our youth, Brother Jabari. Brother Jabari, in terms of looking at the role of institutions, the educational institutions, and being an African youth in the institution, we realize that for some reason or another at European institutions, there's a high dropout rate at a European institution versus a so-called African institution. Based on your experiences of going through a European institution, what were some of the pitfalls or some of the issues that you felt like created obstacles of our students being able to survive through the 4 years or more at a European university? And Sister Rose, you may also speak that too, given the fact that you constantly, you know, deal with students from all races and colors and background. Brother Jabari? You still have Brother Jabari there? Okay, let's go with Sister Rose. Can you maybe speak to maybe some of the...
I'm back. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Brother Jabari. What are some of the obstacles or issues that prevent African, particularly African males, from being successful at many European institutions? What could you share with us, if anything?
Well, I can speak from my educational experience. One thing is that those particular classes at a lot of European institutions that they say are deemed to focus on people of color, a lot of times they're either using antiquated teaching material or the teachers are very lackadaisical about their approach to teaching the subject matter, or the subject matter may not exist, because I know at my particular school, the departments went through an overhaul and all the professors that I'm familiar with, either they left the department or and no longer teaching at the school for one reason or another, they were denied tenure. It's just like I can remember a professor said some years ago, if you didn't see black students on campus on a daily basis, what evidence would there be that there was a black presence? Because there is no real, outside of maybe one particular school being named after a governor and former mayor of a particular city, there is nothing really to acknowledge the black presence. So, you know, if there's a sense of antagonism, you can understand that, because like we were there, we left our mark. We were important to contributing to their academic success, but nonetheless, we don't necessarily get proper respect, but that's a trend when you're not doing something in your best interest, because that's the only way you will get that proper respect. And then even if you look at the course selection, you're not really dealing with a lot of issues, you know. Looking at subject classes, it's almost like we said earlier about perspective. Instead of getting to the core of what the issues are, people either skirt around it or they find a way to distort what the reality actually is. So it's propaganda 101 through and through and through from year one to when you're supposed to be finished.
Rose, can you maybe share some of the things that you have observed in Canada that being counterproductive in terms of not allowing our kids, our children to be as productive as possible when they're in these institutions? And what can we do to change that?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello?
Yes, we can.
Well, first of all, I have to say one thing. I have to go back, and then I'll answer really quick. I am an African American. Too many of my ancestors have shed blood on this land for me not to claim it as mine. And I feel very strongly about that. And I have the right to have all privileges that any citizen in this country should have. That's what I mean by African-American, okay? Okay, now to answer that, the education part, I don't think there's enough support system for students of color. And most of us have been educated, most of the instructors have been educated very whitely, so we teach the subject matter the same as any white professor would teach the subject matter. We've been educated in the institutions in America. We have been given a curriculum to teach, and most of us teach that same curriculum. And that's what happens. And that's what happens for black instructors as well as white instructors. But, you know, white instructors are going to teach whitely, and a lot of black instructors teach whitely as well. I don't know how else to say it.
That's interesting. Anybody else would like to speak to their experiences and maybe address the question? Bamboshi, Haki, Mail, Miss Katie, all your have involved with the institution,
she has,
so I know y'all have your experience.
She's correct. She's absolutely correct, because to speak and to teach from a black perspective makes people uncomfortable. Teaching is an art. One must have the skill to know how to approach that curriculum and incorporate the black culture into that curriculum. Because a lot of cannot do that, then you're dumbing our children down, and you are putting our children in a position where they want to choose the white doll over the black doll, and they think that white is a privilege, and they would like to be white rather than black. So we become the caveat. The black educators become the caveat to help that child develop a paradigm in which they can exist in racist America. You can give that to them with your art, with your skill, with your intellect, and helping them to incorporate that curriculum of which you have been given, which you yourself have been taught and embraced. You can pass it on in a different way. And that is the beauty of it all. And when someone said that, yes, the mother is the first teacher that a child knows, before that child goes to kindergarten, before that child goes to first grade, the mother, could be the father too, will be the first teacher the child knows. And if that parent has the skill to alter whatever they see in the environment to that child's advantage and say, I'm preparing you for life. I'm preparing you for the reality. I'm preparing you for when I'm gone. You might embrace this. You might see this. This might happen. Be prepared. I was recently at a conference. There were 300-plus professionals there, and only three blacks out of about 300. And the other two blacks were afraid to talk to me. They were afraid to say hello, Katie. So some of the white folk, they embraced, but when I tried to embrace the other two blacks, they walked away. As if to say, well, I can't be seen talking to you because, you know, they'll think that we are plotting something, or they'll think that we are gaming on them. And I'd say, okay, nice to see you. Talk to you later. And I understood that they had embraced the same thing that the sister just talked about. They were taught whitely. They were embracing whitely. They were comfortable being whitely. They were still not comfortable in their own personhood.
Katie, can I stop you for 1 second and address this to the whole panel? Somebody listening to this program, just looking at it for me from a common standpoint of view, they may ask themselves, what in the hell are we doing sending these kids to the school? What is it that we gain to stand to send them to these institutions if they can turn out the way we are turning them out? What is the advantages of going to these institutions? Brother Haki. Brother Mill.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. The advantages of sending them to university? Are you talking about the African universities?
If the universities is, no, if the European universities, what I'm hearing tonight, are catered towards to change us into something that we are not, to make us act against our own self-interest, then what is the advantage in sending them to institutions like this or like these, and when the change going to stop?
Well, Lee, I think very simply, I mean, the old adage, you know that enemy. I think it's important to go to these institutions and to learn as much as possible. I think it's extremely important to understand how these people think. I remember, you know, as a young man back in the day in college days, you know, one of the things that was a eye-opener for me was the whole issue around economics, because I had come from a, you know, like church background, and so I had a fundamental understanding of what's right and wrong, a very strong sense in terms of what's right and wrong, in terms of the community norms. Only to find out in the university that those norms that I held, in fact, in the white world, were perceived as somehow esoteric or, in fact, non-existent. So I had numerous clashes with my white professor, you know, and, you know, philosophical clashes over economics. And this guy had a great disdain for me, but the fact is that there's nothing he could do because, you know, I studied, so I understand the material. I can give him back what he wanted, you know, but I also understood that a lot of things that I learned were in my estimation, were BS. I don't see in terms of any benefits in terms of, you know, exploiting another human being. I don't see any benefits in terms of, you know, using another human being. I don't see any benefits in terms of, you know, not sharing the wealth. So I had a fundamental philosophical problem in terms of a lot of stuff that I learned. But it was important to learn in order to understand the system. That was important that I learned that. So now when I listen to these politicians, I listen to these economic professors, you know, on television, I listen to them, I have a great appreciation of what they're saying, and I understand the intimacies in terms of what they're saying. And I'm in a position where I can articulate, you know, what they're really saying, the people who listen to them, who may not get what they're saying. So I think it's important to go to these universities to learn. And, of course, you're right, Brother Lee. The object of universities, of education generally, is to indoctrinate. But the thing is that what we have to instill in our children, what is important, is that you must take upon yourself to go to the library to truly educate yourself. Education can only truly come about is when you do it for yourself. Nobody can teach you everything. You have to do that for yourself. And so our kids have to understand that. You go to the universities, you learn what they have to offer, but the same token, you go to the library and truly educate yourself. So you leave the university or high school, whatever, a more rounded person. So I think it is important, you know, to go to these universities because we have to understand the system. If we have any chance of changing this insanity, you know, then we have to understand how it works. So I think it's extremely important.
Brother Van Boschi, if these institutions transform us into neocolonial agents, if these institutions are transforming our people into neocolonial agents, how do we stop that?
I'm saying I would agree with Haki wholeheartedly that the purpose of the educational institution is to create a norm, a set of folks who will function under the system. And, you know, we should not be in any illusions about what the system is. Is that this country was populated by some indigenous people that were called Indians, Native Americans. This was their land. Another group of folks came from Europe, colonized this land, and committed genocide against the Indians. And today, even today, the Indians are still oppressed and exploited on concentration camps, which they call reservations. They have the worst health. They have the worst housing. They have the worst education today. Today in
2020. In terms of two fundamental questions, I'd like to address everyone, which I believe is very crucial. We have some technical problems with the noise in the line that we can't control right now, but we're going to do the best that we can. In terms of this question that Harold Cruz raised in his book, The Crisis Among the Negro Intellectuals, which he stated that historically there has been three paths, three choices our people must face in order for us to truly get our liberation and freedom. And basically, those paths were either to stay here and integrate into the capital system, stay here and separate and be in our own nation, or the third choice is to integrate and go back home to Africa. He said that choice must be resolved by the so-called intellectuals among our people. Until we resolve that issue, we'll continue to stay stagnated the way we are. What is your view on that particular question in terms of identifying the correct path that will lead our people towards our final destination of freedom and liberation? We can start with you, Brother Bamboshi.
There's a lot of interference on the line.
Yes, a lot of noise. Sometimes we encounter these things and we can't control it. But we're going to try to do the best we can. See if you can talk a little bit over there, but I bet you can with it. Let's go ahead. Mail.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, let's start with you. Let me just get your take on how to request question. Non-therapy resolved is the number of which path is correct path will lead us towards our liberation. Stay here, integrate the capitalist system, stay here, separate, create our own nation, or integrate and go back home to Africa. Where are you on that question?
Well,
that's the issue that's been splitting our people since we've been here, and it got to be resolved.
Yeah, no, Lisa. The interference is too much. I can't even hear the question. The last thing I can hear is clearly the Bamboshi before he stopped. And this interference is almost like it's back in and it causes cut in and out. But I couldn't quite get to the question. I'm sorry for that. I would respond to what Rosa was talking about and the sister previously about this way of education in the college. And it maybe touches on this Harold Cruz question as well. But much of that higher education motivation has been to get into the system again, to get a job. Education almost as trade school, even at the university level. You need to be prepared in order to become a wage earner or professional in the society. Necessary potential in the life. In the process, I think it's helpful that people learn how to learn as part of the educational process. In that way, they become more of an independent thinker, regardless of the institution involved. If they can manage to get that out of it, that will carry them some distance, regardless of the obstacles. But much of it has been, as was said, a part of the process of indoctrination and the molding of the student into the given system and its values. So we have that problem, and Cruz touched on a lot of what that meant for the black intellectual, of a real grounding in peoplehood again, and the attempt to launch into the oppressor's paradigm more than not. And of course, there was a great deal of debate, respectful debate between Cruz and John Henry Clark on that issue. I think we are continually measuring ourselves and educational process included and educational results by the measure of our oppressor and by them that we're in. And as the sister, Katie, I think, mentioned, being American, African American, we are in the system. And I think Sister Rose mentioned being in America and being in the system. Yes, we are, but we don't have to accept what we're in. We are about trying to change it, and we're trying to create something that works for us. And part of that creative process requires us to look back and regain some things that were taken from us and that were denied us, and recapture our identity as we go. And I think that speaks to a lot of of the question. And of course, Cruz, I think, spoke very, very, very eloquently and at length to much of that.
Okay, Sister Lee, could you give me, Rosalie, give me your perspective in terms of addressing the question of Harold Cruz? Historically, there are the three choices we ever had, and not until we choose collectively a path that we believe the correct one, we continue to flounder the way you're floundering. Where are you at on the question of what path you think would be the correct path that will lead our people to their final destination of freedom and liberation, Sister Rose? Do we stay here and integrate? Do we stay here and separate, create our own nation? Or do we integrate and go back home to Africa? Where are you at in terms of, from an indirect perspective, looking at our history, what would be the correct and the best path for our people, Sister Rose?
All three. All three. I see all three. I'm an African of the diaspora. So I understand that I'm here involuntarily, and I am an American, but I'm an African, and I claim my identity as an African. And in some ways, I have isolated myself within my own country to understand my identity. But I also, and I always have a home I can go back to. I always know I can go to Africa and be accepted. But I'm here to fight the battle of, like, and I believe Harriet Tubman said, if I can't have liberty or death, if I can't have one, I'll have the other. So I believe that. And I think that it is a freeing of the mind. But what we're doing tonight, I think, is very important. But we're talking to people we're preaching to the choir and not to the masses. And every day I feel like I'm among the masses. And this conversation, they could not hear at this point in time.
Okay.
So it's an issue. It's great to speak to other like minds and people who think like this, but we have to be able to communicate at the level of the masses. And most young people are going to college to get a job in a capitalist system. They're not thinking about their liberation.
Mm-hmm.
They're conforming. They're not critically thinking. They want that A so they can get that job. So, and I hear you, and I think it's very good for, you know, it's a great chance to have a chance to talk to other people who think like I think. But I understand when I go to class on Monday, who my students are too.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent point. Well, raised. This is the reality of the different ideas among the people. This is why we want to have this dialogue. And we think not only what we're doing, but we are making history, and we become a valuable tool for our people later on to be used. What we do today don't necessarily mean that we have an impact on those today, but you never can question the impact it may have on those in the future. So we don't only do those things for today, but we also recognize that there is a future for others who will be coming after us. So in continuing this path, Brother Hackey, what is your position on this question about Harold Cruz in terms of finding the correct path that will lead to our people find a destination of freedom and liberation? Do we integrate here? Do we separate and stay here? Or do we go back home? Well,
I
yield
like
the question.
I like two and three. You know, I think
do two and three.
I think they're like two and three. I think the idea in terms of, you know, like the Republic of New Africa, the vision that they take in terms of, you know, the three and those five states in terms of creating an African homeland here in the context of North America. That's something that appeals to me, and just in terms of empowerment of our folks. I mean, if we're going to truly progress, you know, in this society, I think at some point we got to really question, you know, the importance in terms of land, just in terms of even being in a position to even deal with the idea in terms of actually being, you know, genuinely liberated. So I think the question of land is very, very pertinent. I think in terms of a strong Africa, that's no question. I think the old adage in which the old African People Revolutionary Party pushes in terms of, you know, no African is free, no African anywhere in the world is free unless Africa is free, is very, very true. And I think the analogy is when you look at China, and you look historically, when you look at in terms of how Chinese were portrayed in the media, it was pretty horrible. Now when you look at the portrayal of Chinese on television, it's a totally different ballgame. It's because the people in this society respect the Chinese. And so, therefore, you know, it's reflected in terms of, you know, how they treat Chinese people. So I think that two and three for me is probably is the way to go. I know I'm not now in saying that. You know, I do understand that, you know, it's not going to be easy. I mean, I realize it's going to be a struggle in terms of bringing these things about. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of disorganization and lack of information that permeates both here and back home in Africa. So there's a lot of work to be done. And so these create structures internationally in terms of being begin this discussion around, you know, Pan-Africanism. I think it's good that the AAPRP is innovating that structure, because we're going to need it in terms of trying to just impact upon the people. But let me say one thing real quick in terms of I just want to go back. I know I'm sort of late in the ball game, but this question around Obama and you know, a lot of people have the perception that somehow when you critique Obama, that you're anti-Obama. And I think the thing we have to understand is that critiquing Obama doesn't make you anti-Obama. It simply means that you're a realist. And I think that when we think about just in terms of how power flows in society, we understand that these presidents are figureheads, that they perform their office within the context of, you know, the avenues available to them. They're not free to arbitrarily go outside the lines in terms of implementing change. Now, the thing is that we're very interesting. And when you look at when you contrast Obama with George Bush, one of the things that when George Bush was in power, he did a lot of presidential directives. He, in fact, without Congress say so, he moved the country to the right, simply by president, you know, electives, in which he said, well, you know, I want certain things to be done, so here is a presidential directive, and so therefore, you know, I'm not concerned with the concern of Congress. Obama has been reluctant in terms of pushing presidential directives, and the reason why, I suspect, is that he understands that just in terms of his own political longevity, that is best to play ball as opposed to standing up. And one of the things that really gets him a crawl was the fact that the whole question around the racism conference in South Africa, when he stood up and said America would not participate in a racism conference. And I said to myself, now, if this man is willing to say to the world that racism doesn't exist in America, or that somehow the concern of racism doesn't adversely impact on the African community, if in fact that is the implication of the stand that he took, then I think it's a very, very dismal one. It's a very, very sad stand that he took. And I can only allude to the fact that perhaps he did that because he understands where the real power lies. So we got to understand that when we think about democracy, we had one thing we had to discount, this notion that, in fact, democracy exists in America, because it doesn't exist in America. It never existed in America. America has never been a democracy. It's always been a republic. That's the reality. But at this point in history, what we're talking about is an oligarchy. And there's nobody that can question the fact that the power, that the 1%, the capitalist class, rule this country. We got to be very, very clear on that. And we cannot deceive ourselves into thinking about somehow this is democracy, and that, in fact, Obama oversees democracy, because he doesn't. He's beholden to the same powers that George Bush, Clinton, Carter, and the rest were beholden to. So we had to understand that fundamental reality. In terms of wanting to bring about real change, the only change that he can bring about is symbolic change. He may be able to speak in reforms now and then, but in terms of substantive changes, the kind of real changes we need, Obama's not going to articulate that. When you look at the large number of African people in prisons, now, clearly, there are people in the UN talking about genocide. You would never hear Obama say that what's happening to African youth in the society is tantamount to genocide. He's not going to do it. So does he serve the interests of African people? Hell no. He does not serve the interests of African people. So let's not beat around the bush and pretend like somehow, because this man is the president of the United States, that somehow his aspirations or his concerns are our concerns, or that he care about the systemic injustices that inflict our people, because he doesn't. And we have to be clear on that. So, you know, that's all I want to say. But back to your other question, our 2 and 3 is probably preferable in my estimation.
Okay, I can hold on for the next 2. We have a listener who just called in. I believe we have Sister Empress on the line, the sister who was the creator, the originator, and the convener of the Million Women March. Sister Empress, 3802, Walk Through Africa on the Move. Are you there? Can you hear us?
Greetings to you all. Yes, greetings to you all. Thank you for inviting me to participate in tonight's program. As usual, my brother, you always are bringing forward some very powerful information and dialogue.
Yeah, Sister Empress, one of the things we are speaking on is the theme of what must be done in the African community to change our current realities. And you have done something that history will always be grateful for in terms of our people. That is to create and play in the role of creating a movement for our people, a Million Women Movement. Can you just give us a sense of what is that you want to do with the movement and what are some of the work you're doing now from your perspective?
Well, brother, you know, it's interesting that you just asked that question, because just as of maybe an hour or so ago, we began to move forward with some of what we had envisioned when we started this movement. As you all know, especially those who kind of keep abreast of where we've been going and what we've been doing over the years, it has been very complicated. It's always complicated whenever you're doing something that is really in the sync of our ancestors in terms of freedom fighting. And what I mean by that is to apply the implications of self-determination in the way that is really going to, at the end of the day, really represent and mean something. And our position has been, we're looking at longevity. We never wanted to do a one-day event. That was never the intention. We had to start somewhere, and we did. And we did so quite grandly, if I may add. But the idea was to make certain that we were to move forward and make certain that the generations to come would have something that they could connect to, something to build from, and so forth. And so today, I think we kind of reached a point of seeing, well, okay, yeah, we're on the right track. We've been working to build something and understanding what's going on in our community today, the apathy that we now see. Things can happen in our community today, and people look at it in like a few moments and go, okay, and then go right on back to what they were doing. And so obviously we've got to apply tactics now that is going to bust through some of that. So one of the things that the Million Women Movement had decided to do from the national office, from the originating entity, is that we wanted to start with something. And of course, the Million Women Movement as a movement is geared to our women and girls, but also to all of our community as well. But our first kind of motion is to connect with our sisters. So what we've been working on, my brothers and sisters, is to begin to do something in the community that we knew was going to make a difference. And so we've been putting a call out here in Philly, in the tri-state area, to get a bus, a DUS bus. We were looking to get a bus that was in bad shape and that we would then renovate it. We got enough folks that have enough skills where we would renovate it. And as long as the bus could be operable, you know, we was ready to take it. Hopefully they would donate it to us, or if we had to pay for it, it would be at a minimum cost. But we would have that bus renovated. And we would then take that bus once it's renovated, and we would go all over the city in our communities, different locations, different days, and we would offer free services to the women, GED preparation, literacy development, that's on one end. The other end would have lunch. We would give them a salad, soup, bread, a nutritional lunch, light lunch, but very nutritional. And then the other thing, too, was some self-esteem development component, as well as health information. That's what we would start with. This project would come strictly from our people. It's no grants. There's no corporate sponsoring, none of that. Nobody's going to get paid, none of that. It's all volunteers. We decided to do that because we had to show our people not only that we're serious and committed to what we're doing, but that we can do this. We don't need Coca-Cola or Nike or somebody else to always sponsor everything that we do. So we decided we would do this. And that's all. So now, this is the process. So we said, now what can we do while we're waiting for the bus? Well, we said, we get a tent. Just like preachers and other things go through different cities and different states and carry their big tent and put it up and had a revival service, well, we said, let's get a tent. And then we get that tent, and we'll put that tent up, and we'll still do the same thing. Well, roughly an hour or so ago, we was telling the sister, look, put the word out because this is what we're trying to do. This is what we're going to do. The sister then said to us, listen, we're going to donate to you a piece of property for you to set your first tent or whatever up in. Said, my mother owns a piece of property. The family owns a property here in Philly. And see, as a part of gentrification, what has happened, a lot of just blank pieces of land now is existing throughout Philadelphia because they're going to change the whole concept of Philly. They're moving folks from the hood out to what they call the Northeast, and they're turning the hood into this luxury location kind of stuff, okay? And they're doing it all over the country. If you've been following what we've been doing, you've been hearing us talk about it. Well, this sister says, look, she says, my family owns a piece of this land here, and we're going to donate it to you so that you can do that. This just happened like an hour or so ago. So, family, what I'm saying is that when you stay focused and stay committed, it might be a bumpy road, as many know. It will be. It might will be. But if you're talking, and especially if you're talking about really making a difference. Now, can you see us going into the community? Can you see us doing GED prep, literacy advancement, along with a meal, along with some dialogue for sisters, along with other things that can develop from that, and also presenting health information, doing this on a consistent basis all over the city certainly is going to make a difference. All we're asking for is people to donate an hour of their time. Those who can, okay, you can donate some produce. Those who can, if you've got some paper or pens or something that you want to contribute, fine. Whatever, some napkins, whatever. The idea is to demonstrate self-determination, to demonstrate commitment, to demonstrate the capability to do for our people without anybody else getting involved or interfering. So, brother, to answer your question, what can we do? Hopefully I answered that question.
Okay, we're going to let our listening audience know that we're going to go over a few minutes. And if you want to hear the entirety of this program, you can always go to our archive by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/africa-on-the-move. But what we can do right now is there's a special case that I've been an advocate on, and I think it's very important that we talk just a little bit about this case because it really typifies what's going on among our youth, what's going on in our community, and our relationship to each other. I'd like to have Sister Katie to maybe talk a little bit about her son, Michael Fulton, what's going on with him, and how the community could help in the sister. Sister Katie, can you please do that, please?
Yes, I can. Michael is a young man who has not had a problem with law enforcement, and he's done very well in his academics. And I think that at this point, he's a target. They're looking to build a case against my son based on his computer. And they're saying to me that they are using information that they found on the computer to build a case against him. And he's saying to them, I have no idea what you're talking about. He was not home when they came to our home and seized his computer. So he's back and forth into Douglas County Court trying to defend himself. At this point, the district attorney is indicating to the judge that, well, we need more time to see what we can search and what we can find. And his lawyer is saying, well, you know what? This has to stop sometime. You have to stop this at some point. We need to exclude anything else that you have not found within the last 9 months to a year. If you haven't found it in that length of time, chances are it's not there. So now we are trying very hard to build a defense on his behalf, and we are asking the public for support. We do need to have a computer expert examine that computer that they have seized, and we do need to have legal representation because my understanding at this point is that it goes to jury trial or take a plea deal. He says, no, I cannot take a plea deal. I cannot plead something I have not done, and I cannot throw my life away based on the fact that you're saying something's on my computer which I have no knowledge of. So he said, we have to go to jury trial. So now it's at a point where he said, well, you know, if you go to jury trial, you might be found this way or you might be found that way, and you would be throwing your life away. Because we can't tell the jury that if you come back with a negative verdict, then you'll have to register for the rest of your life as a sex offender. And he said, well, that's just a chance I'll have to take. And that's where we are now. So we are asking the public to not only be aware of the fact that they can use your computer, your email, and any technology against you without your knowledge. They can invade your computer. They have other individuals who can tap into your computer system. And this is what the DA is trying to do. They're trying to build a case against my son based solely on his computer. So we're asking if you care to know more information about what we are going through, please email us saveoursons2013@gmail.com and we'll be glad to respond at Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Post Office Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado. That's Inglewood with an E, N-G-L-E-W-O-D, Inglewood, Colorado, 80151. We will be glad to accept any donation on behalf of Michael and his defense fund, and we will be glad to answer any questions you might have. You can also call me at 720-499-5146. This young man is struggling for his life, his freedom, his future, and he does not deserve what Douglas County is doing to him now.
Can you just talk about some of the financial burdens that you have to deal with at this point in time when it comes to legal fees? Because one of the things people know that this question of justice isn't about what's right or right or wrong. A lot of times it's all about your ability to have money. And one of the things advocacy for Michael, myself, I've had a chance to work very closely with him. We do want to let the people know that in terms of the legal things, lawyers have looked at the case and say he has a very good sound case of defeated. But the problem is they are not going to move unless they get a minimum of $20,000 to $25,000, even knowing that this man has been railroaded. So briefly speak a little bit to that, and then we'll move on. Because we think that it's very important as a community, if we're talking about saving our youth, and we are given the opportunity to display that, we need to do that. And I think Michael is one of the many youth throughout our community who has been victimized by the use of computer, and the brother needs the community support. So how can we financially help the defense fund that y'all have set up?
The defense fund, Save Our Sons Defense Fund, yes, you can go to any Wells Fargo bank and make a donation to the Save Our Sons Defense Fund account, and that donation will go directly to legal representation. Again, that's SAVE space OUR space SONS Defense Fund INC, and that will go into an account for his defense. They're saying to us that yes, the computer probably was undermined and used, and we're trying to build a case based on your computer, but we need to hire a computer expert. A computer expert alone would be able to say, this seems to me that this computer has not only been sabotaged, but it probably was used, a back door was used to set him up. So we need to have a computer expert along with a lawyer to examine what they have. And this is the fund that we need, and we're asking for support on. In addition to that, they also had put a GPS on Michael, knowing that, he's not a threat to the community, he's not a flight risk. But they said, well, we're going to try to slam everything we can. Now, in addition to that, they also want him to drop UAs, random UAs. And after 4 or 5 months of that, all UAs were clean. They said, well, you know, we can just stop that now. So he was paying for UAs, paying for GPS, paying to go, to, you know, to get back and forth to the court. So they have done everything they can to destroy this young man. By the grace of God, he's still holding on. He has not given up. And we're asking the public for support. We need you to not only be aware of his story and aware of his experience, but to understand that this young man is innocent. And they are trying to take away his life and his freedom based solely on a computer. This is the way they've written the law. Your help would be very much appreciated. If you could send funds, if you could write to us, or if you could call, any connection at all, any response we get from you would be appreciated. Again, you can go to saveoursons2013@gmail.com, and we will respond. Or you can write to us at Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Post Office Box 58, Englewood, Colorado, 80151, and we will respond to you. Or you can call 720-499-5146. Your help will be greatly appreciated.
Okay, we'd like to thank you. We'd like to encourage our family. Please share it up to your friends, to your churches, organizations, and try to say something to help our sister and our brother Michael. In terms of continue to move forward with our discussion, to Brother Bamboshi, we recognize that you are an organizer for the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC, which is a political party. In terms of this question of what is the correct path, what is the position of APRPGC in terms of which way is forward for our people and why?
Well, the APRPGC is an international Pan-African socialist independent political party. And we believe that the objectives that will resolve all of our problems, and we have problems, the sister just said, you know, this is a question of power. Whether they dislike her son or dislike her, this question of infecting her computer and bringing her son into court on this computer, and then whether he's guilty or innocent, the only way that he will be free is if they come up with a whole bunch of money to help to free him. It's a question of power. So for us, we believe that the only way we can be free and get power is Africa is united under an all-African socialist government. All of Africa. And therefore, the resources of Africa will go towards the benefits of African people all over the world, which will put us in a different perspective all over the world. Just think, if they can't get cobalt from the Congo, which they're doing now by killing many people in the Congo, nobody in the United States will have a cell phone. Because without that coal train, they cannot build cell phones. And Africa has such a great abundance of resources that if our resources go to benefiting the African, we will be in a different perspective all over the world. Just look at what Venezuela has been able to do with just their oil and using their oil resource to benefit the masses of the people in Venezuela, especially the Africans and the Indians. And just think if Africa did the same thing. Not with one resource. We got oil, we got diamonds, we got gold, we got everything. So for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, we think that we have to struggle to unite Africa And it has to be united under a socialist system, not a capitalist system, because if it's all united under a capitalist system, then it will just be a few of us exploiting the rest of us like it is now. So we have been quietly building organizations across the United States since 1972. We organize small groups to study and work. We build alliances. We have allies all over the world. And we're moving forward for this objective. And we ask people to come and join us. We say we need organization. Come and work with our organization. But if you do not agree with our objective, if you do not think you could come and work with our organization, then we would request that you build one that is struggling for the people. And not just one that's struggling for the people, a revolutionary organization. If you don't like our revolutionary organization, build one of your own. But please, please, we need organization.
And you have upcoming African Liberation Day. What can the people expect from this year, African Liberation Day? It focuses on activities for May 17 in Washington, D.C.
Well, we'll have African Liberation Day this year in Washington, D.C. We will bring to the people who attend panels made up of people who are struggling all over the world, people who are revolutionary, people who are progressive, people who are involved in the day-to-day struggle against the beast, including the Venezuelans. And we invite you to come. We invite you to ask the hard questions. We invite you to get the information you need so that you can see which way to go.
And you have a website. Where can they locate your website?
The APRP's website is www.aaprp-gc.org.
Okay, we are in the midst of closing out the program. We have two quick questions we'd like to address to all of our panelists tonight. And the first question was a question that Sister Rose raised earlier. I think it's very critical. We'll start with Brother Mayor first, and that question is, how can we take the type of information and discussions that we have had tonight and involve or expose the everyday brothers and sisters into these type of discussions? How do we communicate? How do we get these kind of discussions with them? Brother Mayor, how do we do that?
Well, I mentioned Winbush's warrior method, which involves establishing a study program at home, parents, and engaging community teachers. And I'm in favor of that and have begun to initiate some of that kind of thing, establishing reading groups in the community center, for example, and developing workshops, in some cases around popular music, getting people and young people in particular involved in regular discussions around listening and critiquing popular music, and from there getting into history. History of music, history of our people, and engaging in establishing some ongoing groups which branch off from the original study into some action in the community, which may be related to other things. But in general, it's a matter of educating for liberation, and organizing. These are some of the kinds of steps. It's on the ground. It's largely grassroots, and it's doable. And that's about as much as I can grasp at this time.
Brother Haki, how do we take these kind of messages to the masses and be able to communicate it in a way that they can understand it? How do we reach them? What would be your take on that?
I think probably the most piggyback on what the brother's saying, probably the most easy way to do it is disseminate newsletters, on a maybe a biweekly basis, and try to spread the word that way. And in doing so, hopefully to motivate enough youth, where maybe you can take upon trying to do various projects around the city, which entails some type of economics, and sort of encourage kids to continue to come. And we give you the opportunity to feed the kids in terms of certain things, in terms of history that they need to be aware of. So that's the way I see it playing out.
Sister Katie, how do we speak to the people, the rank and file,
I think that
make
all
sure
of the,
that they engage these
the
kind of discussions?
I think that all of the suggestions are well appreciated because it is multifaceted. And I think that any approach in which you can generate some thought process and encourage people to communicate and respond is good. As the brother said before, the newsletters and educators, wherever you find yourself, wherever we find ourselves as individuals, we can have a positive impact. Action speaks louder than words. When they see that we're not catering to the drugs, we're not in the street, we're not doing the negative, there's something about us and the way we carry ourselves in our community. It resonates. They may not tell you, they may not speak to it, but they do observe. And I think that when we conduct ourselves in a professional capacity, in a way that sends a message that we know who we are, we know what we want, we know right from wrong, we're trying to do something that is positive to empower our people, and that is truly, that can truly make a difference. So wherever we find ourselves, we can make a difference, be it as an educator, be it through newsletters, be focus groups, or be day-to-day conversations. Anywhere we are, we can make a difference.
Brother Bamboshi, how do we reach the masses? How do we speak to them?
Well, we can do what we're doing now. We can speak to them as we see them on the street. We have a truth, and we can't be afraid to tell the truth. I think that part of our problem is that we don't challenge opportunism. We don't challenge these neocolonial agents. We don't challenge the U.S. media. We don't challenge enough things that are passed off for the truth, even though we know it's not true. I think our job is to challenge all of this.
And going to our Sister Rose, who raised it from the beginning, we need to speak to the people. Sister Rose, can you give us some ideas? How do we make sure we have these kind of discussions where we can reach the masses of our people in a sense where they can understand it and have a chance to participate?
I guess you just have to reach them where they're at, and I agree, we have to be role models. We have to be what we say we are and be real. And I think young people do respect realness, but it's very hard to compete with the media, but I think that all we can be are role models and put that forward.
Okay. Can I, each one of y'all, 1 minute give us a summarization of your final thoughts on this theme, what must be done in the African community in order to bring about, in order to change our current realities? 1 minute. We can start with start at the top, you start with Brother Mayo. 1 minute. Final summation. What you would like to say to the people?
Just that we are in what might be considered a crisis period. It's likely that we could say that for many years or in every era, maybe. But now it's certainly definite what we're faced with, and I think much of what's been discussed here tonight is revealing and expresses knowledge of that and some hope as well, and some steps that we just pronounced. steps to take
Sister Rose.
I would say educate and organize.
Sister Rose, give me a good 30, 45 seconds. Closing summary. What would you like to say to the people, your final statement?
I guess we just have to keep plugging ahead, you know, and I'm hopeful, too. I'm very optimistic. In some ways, it was easier before because racism was so blatant. Now it's so subtle. And our children don't recognize it the way our parents recognize it and we recognize it. And it's harder to talk to them about it because they do think they're free. And they are free to go to jail, and they are free to have, poverty, basically, and be uneducated. But I am hopeful. I think that we'll keep working at it. That's what we have to do.
Brother Haki?
You know, I just would like to see maybe a convening of, different political groups getting together sort of a sharpened analysis in terms of way forward. I think we really need that. I think if we're sincere about in terms of organizing the mass of our folks, then we have to, as those of us are conscious, we have to really sharpen our understanding of the world that that we live in.
And Bamboshi.
Yeah, I basically agree with everybody. Inside our party, we say that we have three struggles. The first struggle is against our external enemy. Those people who are not us, who come to fight against us, they're not our allies, they're our enemies. I think the second struggle is against those amongst us who fight for our enemy, those neocolonial agents amongst us. And the third struggle is against backwards ideas within ourselves. It is this third struggle that's the most important struggle, and this is a struggle that we must win first, if we're going to win the rest.
And last but not least, Sister Katie, your final thoughts.
Recognizing the power
Sister Katie? Okay, I think we lost her, but in closing, we'd like to thank all of our panelists tonight and our listening audience for giving us the opportunity to come into your home, discuss the theme, what must be done in the African community to change our current realities. One of the things we wanted to achieve for this program tonight is just to give you some information, because we know that as human beings, what information can you think? And we also wanted to introduce you to some of the organizations and people in your community that are doing things. Because without organizations, there cannot be no serious change. So we like to encourage the people to join an organization that's doing something for their people and understand the importance of information. And if we can get these two things and put them together, then we are guaranteed to have a bright future. Until next time, next week, April 25th, we ask you to tune in from 10 to 12 at the same time, at the same channel, and call in and participate on Africa on the Move. Until next time, we thank you, and let's continue to go forward, ever, backwards, not forward, ever, backwards, not we. We thank you all, and hope that you all night, all will have a good night. We see you next week.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.